This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Science and Technology Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Nupur. Today, we are speaking to Dr. Rob Kitchen, a professor and an ERC Advanced Investigator in the National Institute of Regional and Spatial Analysis at Maynooth University, Ireland. We're speaking to Rob about his new book, Data Lives, How Data is Made and Shape Our World. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks very much for talking to me.
To start us off, could you please tell us a bit about yourself, your academic journey, and your primary research areas of interest?
Yeah, so I'm a geographer by training, although I've worked in a social sciences research institute for nearly 20 years now. So I'm kind of a bit broader than just geography these days. I mean, I started off in a kind of a more science kind of background and was using kind of statistics and was writing code to draw maps and run analysis on my PhD, which was a joint PhD with geography and psychology. I moved away towards more kind of social theory then once I'd moved off into a kind of post-PhD period. And I really started to look at technology and society. So my first book was about cyberspace in 1998. And then I was kind of interested in kind of mapping the internet and the kind of relationship between what the internet was enabling and how society was developing. Questions around things like urban regional development and so on. And then got more interested in software.
Okay. That was my second question to you, which is that I know based on your academic journey that you've been especially interested in questions of spatiality. Is that what brought you to the questions of data processes and politics beyond urban or geographical data per se?
Yeah, and it probably stems from kind of critical GIS. And so an interest in spatial data and trying to understand kind of socio-spatial processes and patterns within society. So critical GIS basically takes the view that that there's a kind of a praxis and politics around what the society does and what data are used, and you take them at a kind of objective face value, but you're kind of situated and positioned as a researcher. And you look at the kind of the politics and ethics of what you're doing. So that's when I came towards data, really. I was using it a lot in research. I was running a national policy institute, so we were doing a lot of analysis using large quantitative data sets like the census to kind of analyze what was going on in the country. So a lot of this was based around what was going on in Ireland and also cross-border research, what was going on with Northern Ireland.
Right.
Dealing with Northern Ireland, it became very clear quite quickly that a lot of the data sets didn't marry up with the data sets in the Republic. And that was a big analytical issue. And there was a lot of politics about how you then try to create all Ireland data sets. And I mean, as in real politics, as in having to talk to politicians and policymakers about new data sets or trying to alter how surveys and political instruments were actually being developed and used.
Okay. So in the introduction to the book, you do kind of talk a little bit about the data projects and context that informed this particular book, because in this case, you reflect a lot on these different projects that you've been a part of. Would you mind telling us a bit about these projects or the settings that you were in that have inspired this book?
Yeah, so a part of what we were doing in this research institute was trying to build data infrastructures that would help researchers undertake their research. We got a grant in 2005 to create this All-Ireland Research Observatory, which was explicitly about trying to link these data sets together across the border and to harmonize the data. At the same time, we were developing the Irish Qualitative Data Archive. So on the one side, quantitative spatial data. On the other side, in qualitative data, so focus groups, interviews, artwork, photos, music, old newspapers, whatever it might be. And that project then led on into the Digital Repository of Ireland, which is a national data infrastructure that brings together all the museums, galleries, libraries, the national broadcaster, to try and create a federated data infrastructure, a trusted infrastructure that would act as a repository for their data, but also kind of a data harvester for their data to interlink into their own repository. So that's a really big kind of 100-year project, you know, this data is meant to be there for the next generation. Partly being inspired by the fact that, you know, this digital data is particularly vulnerable to being lost, and Ireland lost a lot of its national data in 1922 when the national data repository, so the public records office, was blown up in the Civil War. We lost all the land records and the parish records, the census records, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, if we want our grandchildren, our great grandchildren, and so on to have archives based on born digital data, then we repository. So that's what the Digital Repository of Ireland was doing. And recently I've been building city dashboards. So I've been working with Dublin and Cork municipalities to try and create dashboards based on real-time data from census and kind of public administration data. So on the, you know, part of what I'm interested in is actually building these technologies. And what I'm interested in is critiquing and thinking through the kind of politics and praxis and ethics of these technologies. So I'm trying to do both sides. Yeah, in some kind of balance. So, I mean, you know, I think if we're going to develop these kinds of technologies, then we need to be quite critical and reflect about what it is that we're doing. Mm-hmm.
For sure.
You know, and what kinds of assumptions and values and politics get embedded into the technology, and what kind of work these technology does in terms of, you know, how they act, what kinds of questions they enable, what kinds of outcomes do they produce? Do they discriminate? Do they deepen inequalities? Do they empower people? You know, what is actually going on with these things?
Absolutely. So a side question, because I'm not well acquainted with the Irish landscape, is just that you mentioned these really important and interesting things about data related to also cultural history and memory, and hence sort of a sense of national identity. I was just curious, if when you went into some of these projects, what kinds of anxieties or desires are connected and woven into this particular Irish data project?
Yeah, I mean, there's politics in all of them. So the cross-border project, as you can imagine, has a lot of politics between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Any project that tries to create harmonisation between those two jurisdictions always has anxieties. And that was a project that kind of had a stop-start kind of thing, depending on who was the minister in the north. So Northern Ireland have a power sharing government, so which basically means you have unionists and nationalists both in government working together And depending on which minister was in charge of cross-border data at the time, you either made progress or you didn't, because one political party wanted the harmonization and the other wasn't so keen. So there's a lot of politics went in that project. I mean, there were a lot of meetings. Mm-hmm. There was even things like the atlas we produced pulled off of the presses because a political party objected to the title. And so we ended up with the Atlas of the Island of Ireland, which is geographically correct and kind of seen as less political than an all-Ireland atlas. Yeah, so there's those kind of things. In the Digital Repository of Ireland, although there were some questions around kind of memory, cultural history and kind of politics of the state and so on, the real politics in that project were more about who has control over the repository and the relationship between the various stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a kind of politics in finding a neutral kind of organization who was kind of happy enough to have run the project, where, you know, it wasn't seen that the project was being delivered or made suitable for any one particular institution, and respecting that each of these entities would want to retain their own repositories. Now, some of them are too small and they don't have the capacity to build their own infrastructure, so the DRI provides that infrastructure. In other places like the National Library or National Museum, they might have their own data infrastructure.
Right.
And what you want to do is link up across onto the metadata, so you kind of federate their content into your content while it stays on their servers. So questions around ownership and kind of control and so on. So a different set of politics.
Getting to the book that we're talking about today, can you tell us a bit about the origin story of this book? How was it conceived, and like, how did you come to writing also in this particular style and structure that we'll talk about in a minute, which is, I suppose, slightly different from the projects that you've done before?
Yeah, so it's a kind of an academic book, but not told in an academic voice, and and basically what it is all the anecdotes that I use in my teaching to illustrate the points I'm trying to make. So that's kind of why they're more kind of stories and biographical. So I talk to illustrate the points I'm trying to make, the theoretical points or the practical points. I try to talk to the students about real projects, and to talk about are the ones I work on, because I know them inside and out, and I know the history of them, and I know the personalities and the politics that were involved and the technologies that were involved and the choices and decisions that were made, and so on. So that was the idea, was how could I find a way of producing that kind of more anecdotal to a certain kind of material that would be useful for my students, but might be also useful for students elsewhere who want to get a grounded inside look at how some of these kind of data projects work, whether that's open data or whether it's data or whether it's how data infrastructures work. And I've been very involved in the open data kind of movement side of things in Ireland, and working with government departments to open their data.
So when I started reading the book, I did immediately wonder if the wordplay in the title Data Lives or Data Lives was intentional, and the book confirms it. So do you want to speak a little bit to the title?
Yeah, so the title is a kind of, plays both ways. So it rhymes with both gives and with hives. So Data Lives, which is kind of, the book is structured into two parts. So the first part is the life of data. So that's Data Lives, is living with data, and that's Data Lives. I was trying to kind of play on the two parts of the book and the kind of two lives of data, the actual cycle of data itself, and then how data impacts on our everyday lives.
the structure and the content of the book that uses like short fictional stories punctuated with essays, as well as your emphasis on everyday life and liveness, I suppose, makes this book really interesting to read. So would you like to tell us a bit about why you chose this style of writing and how the book is structured? You just said there are two different parts. And yeah, just kind of how people might read the book.
Yeah, so most of my career has been kind of telling stories with data. My teacher and I kind of tell stories about data. And they are kind of based around these anecdotes. So I kind of was interested in trying to come at this in a more playful kind of way that maybe communicates it in a way that will connect with people's everyday experiences as opposed to being quite distant. So a lot of examples are things that people can hopefully relate to, their conversations about, you know, how a dating app works, or how Netflix recommends things to you, or how you might, you know, how you store data, or how the data is being used by companies in relation to you, or how the state is using data to make decisions about you, and the kind of the glitches and the decisions and so on that are involved in that. So I chose to do it in two ways. The first way was through actual stories, so short stories, as a fiction. Now, I've done that before. I edited a book called How to Run a City Like Amazon and Other Things, where we had 38 kind of stories in the book, where each story imagined if a city was run by a different company. So if the city was run by Amazon, if the city was run by Google, if the city was run by IKEA, if the city was run by, you know, whichever company you can kind of think of, and run using their business model. So it was kind of speculative fiction. Whereas in this book, it's more grounded kind of fiction. So I'm kind of interested in stories and telling stories about data, which is, of course, what we do in any case in science. When we write our papers in science, we're writing a narrative designed to convince people about our findings and our conclusions and our theory and ideas and so on. So we produce narrative all the time as academics.
Yeah.
But this is more fiction. And then the second part was more these kind of biographical essays talking about all of these various kind of projects and kind of committees and so on. So a lot of it is grounded in real projects and real scandal. So one of the essays is about the time that the Irish government lost 2.3 billion euros in a spreadsheet error.
Wow! Yeah,
that was amazing. and they didn't notice for a year that it was missing.
Right.
And I served on one of the subcommittees that investigated what had happened. And so right. You know, just kind of now I didn't that is done as a story because I can't say what actually happened. You know, so the stories in a way allow you to also say things about things that you can't say about sometimes because of things like non-disclosure agreements or
right,
or Chatham House rules, or how a lot of these kinds of committees. So that was the way into it, and to try and make it a bit more engaging and a bit more kind of fun. And I'd like to think it works. I mean, I'm kind of 30 odd books in, and this is the first one I think my mother read.
She read it.
Yeah, she's read this book. She hasn't read it.
So, in fact, diving straight into the book, since we have limited time, I did want to at least talk about two different stories. And for our listeners who may not have read the book yet, I'm tempted to recount one story, the first one, to just give the audience a bit of a sneak peek. I thought that the first story was perfect in so many ways to really break through the monotony of, you know, reading about data. Because like you describe in the book, our world is also so inundated with narratives about data that one really has to struggle to stay interested in what's new about you know, possibly most horrific and scandalous stories about data. So this particular story tells us of an awkward date between a sound engineer, Emma, and a tech and data anthropologist, Julian. The crux of the story, as we learn, is that Emma sees sound as data that's already available in the environment. And she sees it as her job to sort of collect the sound data with the best sensors available. And she admits to the possibility of noise in data, but takes serious offense to Julian's comments that all data are cooked. And I thought that was hilarious and very relatable, because as their discussion progresses, Julian kind of keeps insisting how all data are contingent and messy. And naturally, Emma gets quite irritated, because to her, it feels like he's undermining her scientific integrity. So this sort of talking past or provocations might be familiar to STS scholars who have tried to challenge the neutrality, objectivity, and givenness of data. Could you tell us a bit more about what inspired this particular story? And also, as you just said, that often it's, in fact, challenging to talk about actual data events in the real world because of all sorts of, not only like disclosure issues, but also because of their specificity and so on. So what kind of challenges have you also faced when you've been embedded in these projects and spoken to government officials or, you know, family members about data?
Yeah, so, I mean, the story was designed to do exactly what you've said, which was to provide kind of contrast between somebody who sees data as raw and that can be kind of collected objectively and analyzed and made sense of in a very kind of rote, kind of essentialized scientific way. An anthropologist who sees the data as being cooked rather than raw, and that there's a lot of politics and practices involved in what's there, and that the sound data doesn't pre-exist its generation, but that the instruments and the kind of science behind how that works is invented. And you know, if you do things in a different way, you get different data and so on. So the date was a way of kind of being able to have this kind of backwards and forwards kind of conversation between those two people with very different viewpoints about data, and do it in a quite a fun way. She does get quite annoyed with him. At the same time, she can't walk away from him because she needs him for a date for a wedding. You know, obviously somebody thought that they would be a very good match, but that's now I see this in my projects quite a lot, because a lot of my projects involve, on the one hand, computer scientists and data scientists, and on the other hand, kind of sociologists, historians, humanities, social sciences. And I'm kind of, you know, so I do see that playing out, and I do teach. So a lot of my teaching is to data scientists and computer scientists. So I don't just teach in kind of the social sciences. I also teach I run a critical data science course in a kind of ethics of data kind of course for them. And they're quite resistant at the start to these kinds of ideas. What I tend to find happen is that I can usually persuade them quite quickly, kind of using the same kind of arguments within the story. But then what happens is they treat it as an inconvenient truth and try to park it to one side. So that they'll admit to the point of their politics and practices, which is more than mechanical objectivity. The solution is to ignore it or to say that they're trying to find ways to minimize it. So their instinct is to try and hide it. And, you know, so it's almost like a kind of strategic essentialism is adopted. And then we kind of have a ongoing tussles around that. But yeah, that's the typical kind of reaction. Right.
So I did want to ask you if I feel like the story is a foil, it's a sort of shell to be able to actually address a tension that is sort of a long endured and widely felt tension between, like you said, computer scientists or more positivist scholars and more critical data scholars, which is this whole idea of like data as not given, but data as being constantly generated. And I did want to ask you if, you know, with your students, when you do offer them this reframing or this proposition, how do they receive it, in the sense, if even if they agree with you, like, do they ask you, well, so what? What are we supposed to do with this reframing or with this knowledge? And what answer might you give them?
Yeah, so they do tend to be quite resistant. And where I try to push them towards is more critical versions of science, basically. So ideas of critical data science, bring on ideas of critical GIS or radical statistics or critical realism. You know, so there are a number of people who continue to use quantitative data, statistics, kind of mapping and so on, that that have a more critical kind of understanding. So they recognize their kind of positionality and their situatedness, and they recognize the politics and practices in how they're modeling or what kind of work that they're doing.
Absolutely.
And so I try to push them towards that kind of framing, really, which does, as I said from earlier, does draw my kind of history of engaging with critical GIS and so on, which is a long-standing debate in geography going back into the early mid-1990s. So some of the debates that have been going on in critical data studies, I think, have been going on in some disciplines, not just geography, but also sociology and some other disciplines for quite a long time, in this kind of positivist, post-positivist kind of long-standing debates, and then people trying to find a middle ground or an alternative without actually ditching stats and quantitative approaches.
And what happens, not just with students, but I imagine you've spoken about this with also like scientists who sort of come from more confident positions, having done this in their own practice. What happens when they hear this and then they say, well, it's only a matter of the sensors getting better? Because I do know that in the story, Emma basically says that the sound sensors will get better. The technology will continue to get better. So the contingency and the messiness that you're so invested in showing me will eventually reduce or go away. Like, why should I even care? Because, you know, it's only a matter of technological advance.
Yeah, so this is the kind of appeal to mechanical objectivity, to this kind of notion that you can be apolitical in how you go about doing the research. And it doesn't really hold. So you can quite easily undermine that by starting a conversation about, well, where are the sound sensors located, and the whole politics about decisions about where you put your sound sensor. You know, so if you put it in the middle of the park or you put it next to the highway, you'll get readings. If you put it 6 inches off the floor or you put it, you know, 20 feet up a lamppost, you'll get different readings. So it's not just about the instrumental quality of the sound sensor itself. There's other kinds of questions around where you site the sensor, and then there's other questions around, well, what is the sample rate? Are you going to sample the sound every 10 seconds, every minute, every 5 minutes, every hour? You know, what are you going to do with the noise that's in the data? Mm-hmm. How are you going to transform that? And what way are you going to do? Now, they will say that they all use...
Absolutely.
So their appeal then is towards standardization. We have protocols and standards for how we deal with that. But of course, standards are negotiated, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of politics in standards. I mean, there's a huge global fight going on in standards at the minute, really between America and China, about who has control of the various standards organizations and who's driving the agenda. Mm. And obviously, there's different laws and regulations in different places. So in the EU, there are different kinds of regulations around these. So standards are really very highly political. And I PhD student Jim White, who did his PhD on city standards or city data standards. I think 80 different data standards, and they all vary. So which one you pick will make a difference to what you do. So, you know, you just keep having these conversations by also making it clear that what you're not trying to do is undermine their scientific integrity.
Mm.
This is not about rubbishing science. I mean, science is really very, very important. and the developments we make through science are very important to. So we're not trying to damage the reputation of science. What we're trying to do is get scientists to acknowledge where there are particular questions or weaknesses that need kind of rebuttal or answers to what's going on, and to own that kind of politics and practice rather than deny or try to hide it. So instead of pushing the inconvenient truth to one side, it's actually owning the inconvenient truth and driving the narrative around why, even though there might be issues, but the science still has some degree of integrity, which provides some level of value in relation to what it's trying to do.
Right.
Julian is trying to say, look, I'm actually not undermining your science. I think your science is really good. I'm just trying to unpick what's actually going on and what kinds of values or work is being done in relation to the senses, and to acknowledge them rather than deny them.
Right. That's such a fascinating way of putting it, because I feel like if we're able to show more positive as scientists that, you know, critical science studies, for example, is not in opposition to, but in fact devoted and committed to, like, bettering, improving, deepening the scientific practice itself, that might just solve a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, I've had people kind of say, look, what are you doing? You're building this technology, you're building dashboards. Like, why are you undermining your own work?
Yeah.
My answer to that is that I'm building it to destroy it, to build it better. You know, I every project I build, I have every intention of trying to dismantle. Theoretically try to dismantle and empirically try to do it as a way of the weak points to be able to build it in a more robust, rigorous way that is very open and transparent about what it's doing, how it's doing it, what its consequences are, how it acts in the world, what's going on, you know. So it's about being explicit and open and trying to improve, as opposed to trying to hide and try to deny and try to hoodwink, have this kind of shield of strategic essentialism, which is basically, you know, strategic essentialism basically just means pretending that the issues you know are there are not there.
In another story, Gridlock, we get a glimpse of the traffic management system on a bad day, where the sentient machine, Travista, has stopped functioning properly. The human hero of the story, with help from his female colleague, manages to save the day. By saving the day here, we mean that the Dutch Prime Minister is stuck in this traffic jam. And through conversations between human workers, we realize how humans constantly swoop in, compensate for when data and tech systems fail to deliver on promises of efficiency, automation, added intelligence, and so on. And based on the several projects that led you to reflect on the truth of data and how contingent they are, I was wondering if one goal of the book is also to highlight the work that people do in various kinds of administrative positions, varying degrees of expertise, in order to realize and make these promises of datafication come true. And I don't just mean the labor that people perform, but also the role of human intelligence in taking some of these discretionary decisions that sort of get hidden and obscured while we celebrate the fact that data seems to be powering our world.
Yeah, so the Gridlock story is based on actual real field work. So with a postdoc researcher called Claudio Coletta, who did an ethnography of the traffic control room in Dublin. He was based in the control room and observed what was going on in there over a couple of months. And, you know, the system is automated. So it's taking data from kind of 800 inductive loops across the road network. And it's taking data from 400 odd cameras. And it's also pulling data from social media. It knows where all the 1,000 buses on the network are at any one time. And so on. It's trying to use that data to fade to traffic lights in real time. So the how long you wait for the traffic lights is always altering based on the flow of cars and vehicles across the network. But there are people on the loop. So there are people in the control room who intervene when things are not going quite as they should be going. When there's like an unusual event and the algorithms don't quite do what they're meant to do, or there's a special occasion like you want to green light ambulances through junctions, or you know, there's a political parade or there's something else going on. So this has been a kind of debate in the kind of automation yeah. kind of literature around the degree to which people should be involved. So you have a human in, on, or off the loop. So in is the system kind of comes up with a recommendation, but the person always makes the decision. The on is it's automated and it kind of works on its own, but the person can kind of intervene and override. And is the whole thing is just seeded to the algorithm, which just works with relatively little oversight. Where that debate kind of got interesting was the debate over killer drones.
Okay.
Every government was asked whether they would develop systems that were in, on, or off the loop, you know, whether you would seed the killing of people fully to an algorithm, or whether it would always be done by a human, even if identified by an algorithm, or whether it would be some hybrid kind of on the loop system. So that's what that kind of that story looks at, is a person working with the system to try and deal with a kind of congestion crisis when there's a very high value individual who needs to get to a particular meeting. But a lot of the stories have got that kind of relationship between the human and the system. So there's a story called The Secret Science of Formulas, which is a couple of researchers working with a government minister, where he keeps tweaking the algorithm to basically get the result that he wants, but say that it was scientific because it was an algorithm that ultimately made the decision. So he wanted to be able to hide behind the kind of objectivity of the algorithm, even though he's tweaking it constantly. The story called Fighting Fires, which is where somebody who's been a volunteer firefighter loses their unemployment benefits because they've not been making enough job applications, and the algorithm in that system, in the government system, has basically flagged him up as a problem and bumped him out. So even though he's doing volunteer work for the state, another part of the state has bumped him out, and he's having a negotiation with the person in the office. How does he deal with this algorithm and so on? So it's still human mediated. There's a person in that office trying to guide him how to go back into the system and get himself. It's the same one called Security Theater, where it's going through the security in an airport and data that comes up about your travel history and whether you're in any security databases. I mean, that's a mediated story as well. And I've written about that in the past as well, about Security Theater, how different people can negotiate different things through the security, depending on what their background is, and so on. So although in theory it's very technical, in a lot of ways it's actually a very human mediated process, where you kind of have a negotiation with whoever's at the passport control or whoever's controlling the airport security machine, and so on. So people are in these systems in lots of different ways, from the requirements analysis and the coding and the building and the developing, through into its use and how it impacts on people's everyday lives.
I do remember the story about the firefighter who was too busy doing his job so that he couldn't fill out the job applications. And this is precisely what I was thinking about: questions of remediation and how they're placing us in also different kinds of relationships vis-a-vis each other as humans. I did have a question about the data stories part, and I was going to ask you this towards the end, but I think you already hinted at the fact that you've perhaps intended this book to be more of a teaching tool rather than simply just being a theoretical contribution or intervention. So do you imagine that this would be taught in STEM departments or that it would be sort of this valuable aid for instructors who are dealing with students who are otherwise being trained to have faith and trust in data?
Yeah, I to me, it has three audiences, really. I mean, it is a kind of traditional, maybe more STSS, critical data studies, geography, sociology, some of the humanities, media studies, and so on, who are data and data work and the life of the data cycle. Like, it does still have kind of theoretical ideas in the book, and hopefully I contribute to those debates rather than just rehearse them. The second one is around kind of teaching as a pedagogic tool. You know, there's loads of examples in the book. So, the book is basically all of these little stories and anecdotes, kind of illustrations of how things work. So, it provides a lot of kind of real world examples of, you know, what a lot of these systems and infrastructure are doing. And that could be to people on the science side of things, but it's also actually to people who are on the social sciences and maybe in things like humanities and so on. And the last group is actually just a more kind of, it's partly almost like a scholarly trade book. It's aimed at a general audience who are interested in data, you know, what some of these systems might be doing and how they work and how we can kind of think kind of critically about them. That how can we kind of reflect on what's going on and maybe think about alternative ways of doing things or acknowledging what's actually happening.
Right. Towards the end, in the conclusion, you referred to an earlier book which came out last year, which is Slow Computing, that you co-authored with Alistair Fraser. Having established that it is increasingly difficult to entirely escape top-down capitalist data futures, you both call for enacting a digital ethics of care and also the need to claim and assert data sovereignty. Could you elaborate on these two points? What did you mean, and what does that particularly mean in the context of this book?
Yeah, so a digital, a kind of an ethics of data care is around, it's building on the feminist notion of ethics of care, which is about how best to kind of respond to what's going on, you know, that thinks about how we're treated. So it's partly about treating others how we would expect ourselves to be treated. So it's how best to respond to things. It is kind of related to social justice issues, but whereas social justice tends to focus on kind of rights and rules and principles, and so this is a more kind of grounded, embodied, kind of notion of reciprocal care. That's where we've been coming from, and kind of setting out ideas around, well, you know, we don't just have to accept the ways in which data are being used in things like data is being used all the time now to profile us and to make decisions about us, you know, in ways that are really problematic. And a lot of people are aware of these kind of debates now after Snowden and WikiLeaks and Cambridge Analytica and all of the various breaches and all these kinds of things. So I think, you know, people are aware that data is being harvested about them and it's being used to make decisions in relation to them, but we all feel a little bit kind of disempowered in that it's these organizations who are a bit black boxed and bit of a distance, or by the state, who are quite difficult to challenge. So what do we do at a kind of a personal level? What do we do also, just as importantly, what do we do collectively? Like, can we kind of band together to alter what's happening? So this is our idea around kind of slow computing, and we kind of developed this notion of kind of data justice, which is really rooted actually in kind of indigenous scholarship. This notion of kind of data sovereignty, and in the computing book we also talk about temporal sovereignty. How a lot of this technology seems to speed up our everyday lives and create temporal density and fragment our kind of schedules and so on. You know, so we always feel there's not enough time in a day to some degree, and it's because we're busy because of this technology. And so, yeah, so the idea of data sovereignty then is, as well, how do we gain some, autonomy or control over our data. Now, obviously, in Indigenous scholarship, that's about, you know, it's very much about sovereignty. It's about, you know, it's about how data is being used to govern and regulate and control particular populations, and using kind of knowledge structures and ideas that don't tie in with their own kind of worlding and their view of the view and thinking about the world. But in relation to us, it's about kind of interventions where we can get some level of control over what we're doing. So and that can work individually. So we talk about four kinds of interventions. The first one is curation, about being careful about what data we share, because we volunteer a lot of data through things like social media and so on. So and the websites we visit and what we've online for. You know, there's lots of ways in which we give data away. And there's lots of ways in which the data is just harvested, but we can make choices about what technology we use. So we don't, you know, we don't have to have a networked washing machine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about curating the data and what's there. Second one is to use things like open source alternatives. So rather than proprietary software that harvest a lot of data for those companies who see their data as a secondary market, the open source, open access kinds of projects don't ethos. You know, so rather than using the kind of Microsoft system, you use OpenLibra and you know, there's loads of these that, you know, every major software package you can think of has pretty much got a source alternative. The third one is actually to step out of systems. It's to stop using Facebook. It's to stop using technologies that we feel are where their pernicious effects are enough that we would say the benefits are not commensurate with the positives, and maybe we're better off stepping, you know, stepping away from them. And the last one is obfuscation. So the idea, you know, putting in false answers, evasion, non-compliance, you know, trying to mess up the data, basically. So individual ones, and then the collective ones are things like, you know, getting involved in those kinds of projects, getting involved in open source projects, getting involved in civic media, getting involved in, you know, and people, you don't need to be a coder, you know, they're looking for people who also can do accounts and can do marketing and can do, you know, can help organize events and do all kinds of stuff, right? So, but it's also kind of collective action through things like civil rights organizations, so Electronic Frontier Foundation or American Civil Union, Privacy International, these kind of NGOs that campaign around privacy, data security kinds of issues, and push for things like privacy by design and new standards and new legislation that protect people. That can often be done through unions. So within their own organization, unions looking at, you know, what workplace surveillance and pushing back against those kinds of ideas and so on. So it's both individual and collective. I think part of the issue with a lot of the kind of the self-help digital detox literature is it just focuses on the individual. A lot of ways, the real purchase comes off a collective. You know, things like right to be forgotten, the right to disconnect, you know, those kinds of ideas, they come out of collective movements rather than individual action. So it's about doing it at both levels and also kind of having this notion of reciprocal care. The kinds of ideas that can be drawn in here, things like data justice and so on, but it's that kind of space, really, that those kinds of ideas is what we've been advocating for, rather than just accepting all of these kind of data relations,
right?
Kind of resist and challenge them and try to alter them.
I particularly appreciated this phrase or word that you used in the book, which was our data-infused fates. And I definitely feel like times when, you know, in common layperson discussions, we talk about data futures, it really feels like this inevitable, top-down, totalized data fate, as if we just need to sort of subjugate or just give in to it, and there's nothing we can do about it. So I really did like and appreciate the fact that you brought in these two alternatives, which I guess also feel very doable, very feasible, like you said. Because often imagining that anyone who's non-technical reading this book, I feel like a lot of people go away with the question as to how they, with their skill set, can participate in what is being asked in the book. So I did really appreciate that.
Yeah. And there is a kind of a teleology that at work in, you know, in these kind of big businesses around, there is a kind of a fateful, like, this is the way it is. It's difficult to push back. It's difficult to rearrange or to rejig the arrangements as they are. So there is this kind of, this notion of a kind of a data doxa or a kind of, a kind of surveillance realism that, you know, that there's no alternative. There's no way out of the way things are. A lot of what I'm writing about is the way in which things are contingent and contextual, relational, and that there's a lot of space in which to rejig things and to imagine alternatives. You can imagine things like data trusts, for example, give a lot more control to the people who the data relates to, as opposed to the state or proprietary companies and so on.
Yeah, I feel like that's something that this book did for me as well, which was that when I teach undergrad classes to STS or tech students, I often get them to the point where we say, okay, data are contingent and messy and relational, but so what? And if that loop isn't closed with not a utopic, but at least a hopeful answer that talks about sort of empowerment or how you can do things, which this book did really well, which was that, well, if we understand that data are contingent and messy and relational, then that in fact means that we have agency, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a tagline on the book that, you know, it kind of says there's a lot of kind of politics and there's a lot of issues here, but there's also hope. And as you say, the hope is the fact that there are these kind of fissures that can be kind of opened out to, you know, it's kind of reimagine, remake, recast, what these structures are, how they're built, who they serve, what they aim to do, how they're regulated, how they're controlled, and so on. That, you know, they're all, these are not fixed, immutable sets of relations. So that kind of politics is in the book. I mean, the book is like 100% that, you know, it's 100%, you know, what can you do yourself as an individual or as part of a collective to intervene and to imagine things differently. Yeah.
Exactly. This has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you so much. But before we let you go, I'm sure we would all love to know, what are you working on currently and what might we expect to see from you in the near future?
Yeah, so there's a book in press at the minute, The Data Revolution, which is the second edition of that book. So it's 7 years since the first one and a huge amount has happened, kind of big data, open data in the intervening time. But actually more of what's happened is there's just been a huge expansion of academic work on kind of critical kinds of approaches onto data. So that book's been basically entirely rewritten. It's about 70% new content and is it extended a lot. So it's about 50% longer than it was as well. So in September. And then the book I'm working on at the minute is on time. This is on the timescape of cities and the kind of role of technology in relation to that. In my head, it's a kind of the sequel to the Code Space book, which was all about software and space.
Right.
Whereas this is about technology and time. So I'm working away on that at the minute, and hopefully I'll get it finished by the end of the summer.
Nice. That's so good to know. We're excited. I mean, once your new book is out, I'm hoping that we can again get back and talk about it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, and have a good day.
Yeah, thank you very much for having a chat with me about the book.